Okay, good morning. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources.
I'll call to order the House Committee on Energy and Environment.
Okay, well, colleagues, first of all, Happy New Year to you all. Here we are. The curtain is rising on this session that we're about to go into in a couple of weeks. And you will see some changes on this committee because we have two new senators on the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, including one who attended all the meetings when we met jointly previously, but he was a House member then. And that is the new Senator Benz from Eastern Oregon. And we're very happy to have you as part of our side of the room, Senator.
Thank you.
And joining him is Senator Taylor, who is, I have to say, I've been waiting for several years to have a woman on this committee. Mm-hmm. And it's since we had our chair, Jackie Dingfelder, whom I replaced. And it's great to have Senator Taylor, not only because she's a woman, but because she's an extremely capable senator, and also a member of our Subcommittee on Natural Resources for Ways and Means, and will be providing us with some good liaison to that group. Anyway, we're meeting jointly to discuss the two versions of the bill that was once Senate Bill 1070. And as you all, I think, know, it was about a year ago that we heard from our Global Warming Commission that we as a state are not on track to meet the goals that we set a number of years ago to reduce our carbon emissions, our greenhouse gas emissions. And so it became clear that we as a state need to enter into a structured, disciplined, comprehensive approach to marching our level of emissions down step by step until the year 2050. And we searched all last year. We knew that to finalize the policy on that, we would have to work nonstop during the interim, and we did that. And I just want to take a moment to thank our two committee administrators, Beth Petrino and Beth Riley, for the tremendous work that they did. You know, the interim is supposed to be a time for rest and relaxation, but we really have been essentially nonstop in session since the end of July. And what we have to present to you today are the bills that we think are ready to go. And the purpose of this part of the meeting, where we're meeting jointly, will be to walk through that bill in a very detailed manner. Our legislative counselor is going to be, who drafted the bills, will be doing that. And I say bills because we have slightly different versions. We have been working incredibly cooperatively, the two chambers, jointly and in an ongoing way. But at the end of the day, we have slightly different versions of the two bills, and our drafter will explain those differences to you. We then will have time for some discussion of the bills and answers to any questions that you might have. We have Colin from DEQ here to answer any technical questions that we have. We're then going to have a presentation from Lori Wyburn, who's with, I'm forgetting the name, some Forest Trust or something. Anyway. To help answer some questions that I know many people have had about offsets, forest offsets, and the way that they can contribute to forest health as well as greenhouse gas emissions. I just before I turn it over to Representative Helm for some comments, you know, I want to say that, you know, at the end of all that work that went on, we had four work groups, many, many volunteer hours from various stakeholders to, you know, to help us come up with the best bills. You know, I would say that we addressed four broad areas where we had heard concerns about Senate Bill 1070. One was that the bill was not as clear and specific in its direction to DEQ and the agencies as it needed to be to give them clear direction on the rulemaking process. I think, you know, we addressed that in various ways. You know, a second area had to do with governance. There was a concern that there were a lot of committees going on, and how are they going to work together? Who is going to be overseeing them? And ultimately, we decided that, first of all, those committees needed to be consolidated into one. It's a large committee, this advisory committee, 21 member. I think that the stakeholders who will be part of this advisory committee really represent a broad variety of interests and will really be very helpful for this process. But what we also, I think, came to realize was that people wanted to make sure that the legislature, you know, the representatives of the people of Oregon, remained in the driver's seat on this program in terms of the design of the program and also in terms of how any investments, you know, that we have CAP and we have INVEST, and the investment side of things would happen. And so we've designed a program where we are making use of our regular budgeting process as a legislature, creating a new joint committee on climate, you know, half House, half Senate, that will help oversee the rulemaking and also the investments that will occur. And those will be channeled through our regular Ways and Means process. Finally, one thing that really came through in the work group process was in Senate Bill 1070 talks a lot about mitigation and the importance of Oregon kind of stepping up and being a model in terms of mitigating our emissions, but also, you know, something that's very special about Oregon is our ability to sequester carbon, right? We're really good at growing trees. We have a lot of agricultural land that can also capture carbon. We really, along with mitigation and adaptation resiliency, sequestration and storage is also something that this program should really focus on. Because of its ability to sort of turn the tide on climate change, but also because of the really good things it can do for rural Oregon. Rural Oregon is, of course, in the front lines of climate change and the need to adapt to the effects of climate change. It's also a part of the state that has not been benefiting from the economic recovery that the rest of Oregon has to the same extent. And we see this program as a way to really invest in rural Oregon in significant ways. And I will say, I've talked about this aspect of the bill to constituents of mine. And, you know, we're talking about Northeast, Southeast Portland, very urban, you know, liberal Oregon. And whenever they've heard our intent to really invest in rural Oregon, their eyes light up. We hear often about the urban-rural divide, but I can tell you that urban Oregon cares deeply about the situation in rural Oregon. I just wanted to put that on the table. And turn it over to Representative Helm.
Thank you, Senator, and welcome everyone this morning. The first, I wanted to do two things. One is to first thank everyone that's participated and commented during both the 2017 informational sessions and through the work group processes this fall. And I particularly wanted to thank all of the representatives and senators that participated in the work group process during the interim. They gave us many hours of their time on three separate occasions in four different work groups, which is was a request from the senator and I to go over and above what folks usually do in the interim. And I appreciate that. Appreciate your time, and I appreciate your thoughtfulness in doing so. Those folks, and in particular the chairs of those work groups, juggled some very difficult questions. And our request to them was to listen to what the public has to say, listen to what stakeholders have to say, listen to what the impacted communities have to say, listen to what the regulated entities have to say. And I think we accomplished that. And they rendered those comments down into something useful that is now reflected in both the House bill and the Senate bill, and really give us something to chew on as we head into February. The second thing I wanted to say is just to acknowledge the process we're about to go into. We as legislators are continually asked to balance priorities and values in this state. Climate change is an issue that's very, very difficult because it's been happening so slowly. Our impacts on the place we live in have been accruing over time, over the last 100 years, very slowly. We're starting to see the impacts more significantly right now than ever before. The solution to the problem is, by its nature, going to also need to be incremental and occur slowly, because what we have to do is figure out a way to pay for the type of economic changes that we are proposing. And that requires balancing some of the interests that we hold dear, like keeping utility rates low so that folks on limited incomes can get affordable energy. And we have to look at how we're going to adapt to climate change on the ground, because it's happening faster than we can respond to it. So we acknowledge that. So I'm committed to that balancing process. We have the time to do it. And from my perspective, we're all going to end up paying for the way that we adapt to climate change in the coming years. It's whether we want to pay now or whether we want to pay later. And these bills are designed so that as we move toward those actions that are going to address climate change in our state, we do so mindfully, and we do so in a way that is not going to shock our economy. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants that. And so the approach, as you will see, is to move into this slowly and chip away at the problem we have in front of us in the years up to 2050 in a way that gets the job done, but that does not damage Oregon's economy. So with that, I'll conclude my comments and again offer my thanks to folks who participated.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, Maureen, would you come up?
We were blessed during this process with having an extremely capable legislative council drafter, Maureen McGee, who not only is very talented, but she's very hardworking. And she's going to walk us through the substance of the bill, the substantive part of the bill. I assume you're not going to go through each of the whereases.
I think I'll skip over there, those, Chair Dembrough.
But I would encourage you all, if you haven't looked at the whereases to this, this is the sort of why part of the bill. I mean, why are we doing this? And the whereases are the different findings that have led us to try to solve this problem through the policy that's in the bill. But yes, thank you, Maureen.
And thank you, Chair Dembrough, for your kind remarks. Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Power, my name is Maureen McGee. I am a deputy in the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I've been invited here today to walk you through the provisions of LC 44, which I'll also refer to as the Senate draft, and LC 176, which I'll also refer to as the House draft. Now, as Chair Dembrough and Chair Helm explained, the two bills are very similar, but they are not identical. And so for ease of presentation, what I've chosen to do is focus my remarks on LC 44, that's the Senate draft. But as I'm walking through, I will be sure to highlight each one of the differences between the Senate and House draft so that members from both committees can follow along. One of those differences that I do want to highlight at this point, though, is that because the Senate draft actually has a couple more sections in it than the House draft does, the section numbering and kind of internal referencing within each individual bill doesn't line up with the other bill. And I understand that that could cause some confusion for people that are trying to look at the bill side by side. So I encourage you to make use of the table of contents documents that LPRO has prepared and posted to OLIS for each of the bills. Those are one-page documents. And I believe that if you look at those table of contents documents together, that can help orient you to understanding how the two bills line up. So with those preliminary remarks out of the way, I'm going to begin my walkthrough of LC Draft 44, and I invite the members of the committees to join me by turning to page 4 of that draft. Section 1 of the draft defines greenhouse gas for purposes of the air quality laws of this state. Sections 2 through 4 repeal the greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals that are currently provided for in statute and replaces them with new statewide greenhouse gas emission reductions goal for 2025 and new statewide greenhouse gas emissions limits for the year 2035 and the year 2050. And I should note that this provision applies broadly to the total emissions of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions in this state, not just to the emissions to be covered by the program that is established in later provisions of the bill.
And Maureen, if I could just interrupt. So broadly speaking, that increases the goal from 75% reduction to 80% reduction.
That is correct. Yes. By the year 2050,
right.
80% by the year 2050. Section 5 establishes the Joint Legislative Committee on Climate. The duties of the committee are contained in Section 6 of the draft, which generally requires the committee to provide general legislative oversight of climate policy, including but not limited to policies as they move forward that are contained in this draft, and in doing its work to take into consideration the recommendations of a program advisory committee that is also established in the draft, the Global Warming Commission, the Climate Change Research Institute, and the Environmental Justice Task Force. Section 7 is a technical provision. Sections 8 to 10 establish, within the Department of Environmental Quality, a program advisory committee consisting of 21 members appointed by the governor and is further detailed in Section 8 of the draft. And it generally charges the program advisory committee with a variety of advisory duties related to the development and implementation of the program for regulating greenhouse gas emissions that's established in the draft, with particular reference to expenditures and investments of state proceeds from that program. The committee is charged with preparing a report on its recommendations for those expenditures and investments to be submitted to the Legislative Assembly and the Governor each biennium. Sections 1 through 10 of the bill become operative on January 1st of 2019. Section 11 is a legislative statement of purposes. It provides that the purpose of the program established under Sections 12 to 19 of the draft and of the investments of state proceeds from that program are to reduce greenhouse gas emissions consistent with the statewide greenhouse gas emission limits established under Section 4 of the Act and to promote carbon sequestration and adaptation and resilience by this state's natural and working lands, communities, and economy in the face of climate change and ocean acidification. We now come to sections 12 to 19 of the draft. These are really the central provisions in the draft to requiring the establishment of a cap and trade program for regulating greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. The draft provides that the program will become operative on January 1st of 2021, but that rulemaking towards implementation can begin upon passage, upon the emergency clause passage of the bill. So looking specifically to those provisions, Section 12 sets forth the definitions for the program. Section 13, subsection 1, the EQC is generally directed to establish a cap or an overall limit on the total anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions from covered entities expressed in tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, with a cap declining over time. To implement the cap for each year, the EQC will set annual allowance budgets, which means that annual allowance budgets essentially means the number of allowances that are to be allocated. The budget is set in an amount equal to the applicable cap. And it's important to remember that an allowance is defined as a tradable authorization, or essentially a tradable permit to emit one ton of carbon dioxide equivalent. The EQC is then directed to adopt rules for developing the market-based mechanism for covered entities to demonstrate compliance with the program. Subsection 2 of Section 13 sets forth the detailed requirements for what entities the Commission shall designate as covered entities under the program. And would the committees like me to discuss that in detail now? Yes? Okay. So speaking to the specific entities, and again, we're looking at Section 13, Subsection 2 of both bills. First are going to be persons that are in control of air contamination sources that are required to have air quality permits. If the annual regulated emissions attributable to those air contamination sources meets or exceeds 25,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. I will note that there is an exemption here for methane emissions from a landfill that are demonstrated to have been recaptured and used for generation of renewable energy, including but not limited to electricity, transportation, fuels, or heat. Second category of covered entities, and this is going to be electric companies or consumer-owned utilities that are for the regulated emissions attributable to the generation of electricity for which that electric company or consumer-owned utility is the load-serving entity, and if those emissions meet or exceed 25,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. That is, unless the Commission determines that a method other than using load-serving entity for the designating the point of regulation exists that is more accurate or more efficient or that better enables the state to pursue a linkage agreement with other jurisdictions that have cap and trade programs. The next category is going to be electricity service suppliers for addressing regulated emissions attributable to them. And then we get into covered entities for purposes of covering fuel. Natural gas marketers to cover emissions from combustion of natural gas sold by the marketers and that are emissions that regulated emissions that aren't otherwise covered through the regulation of covered entities that are air contamination sources. Next is natural gas utility. And that's going to get at the emissions from natural gas that aren't otherwise covered through the regulations, so not otherwise covered by regulating the natural gas marketers or the air contamination sources. And then the EQC can also designate covered entities as necessary to address regulated emissions attributable to the combustion of other fuels. There are exemptions here. The EQC may exclude from designation as a covered entity a person that imports a de minimis amount of gas and diesel fuel, and it's up to the Commission to determine what de minimis means, and is also required to exclude from regulation emissions from the combustion of fuel that is demonstrated to have been used as watercraft or aviation fuel. So So the rest of Section 13 contains statutory direction for the Environmental Quality Commission to establish compliance rules and other provisions regarding compliance. It requires covered entities to meet their obligations within the program by surrendering to the state compliance instruments equal to the covered entity's total emissions for a compliance period. I'll note here that a compliance instrument can be either an allowance or an offset credit, both of which are further discussed in the following provisions of the bill. Subsection 5 of Section 13 also sets forth registration requirements for participation in the program, and it authorizes the Commission to adopt a schedule of registration fees to cover the Commission and the Department of Environmental Quality's costs for administering Sections 8 to 20 of the draft. So now we've reached the first difference between the Senate draft and the House draft. In sections 14 and 15 of LC 44, that's the Senate draft, there is a temporary exemption from regulation during the first 5 years of the program of emissions of what are known as F gases that are generated during semiconductor and related device manufacturing. This temporary exclusion is not included in the House draft, and the fact that that temporary exclusion isn't included is the precise reason why the section numbers don't line up between the two bills, as I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation. So getting back to allowances, as I explained, under Section 13 of the bill, the EQC sets an annual allowance budget. The DEQ then distributes those allowances. Now, in general, jurisdictions that have cap and trade programs can distribute their allowances in a variety of different ways. And here, the draft provides for some allowances to be distributed for free and some to be distributed through a state-run auction. Section 16 of the Senate draft is where you'll find the detailed provisions for how DEQ is going to allocate allowances free of charge. There are two differences between the Senate and House drafts in the allowance allocation provisions. The first difference involves the allocation of allowances to electric companies, as described in Section 16 sub 2 of the Senate bill and Section 14 sub 2 of the House bill. Under the House version, all of the allowances that are allocated for free to electric companies must be consigned by those electric companies back to the state to be auctioned. Such an arrangement allows for the proceeds from the sale of those consigned allowances to flow directly back to the electric companies for use to benefit ratepayers, as further described in Sections 24 and 25. In the Senate draft, it also provides for this kind of consignment process, but unlike the House draft, it does allow the electric companies to use some portion of their freely allocated allowances as compliance instruments rather than having to consign them to auction for sale. It allows them to do this to the extent that that portion of allowances reflects greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired resources in the electric company's allocation of electricity. This is allowed in the Senate bill, taking into consideration the interaction of the cap and trade program with the modifications to the renewable portfolio standard and the coal to clean provisions that were adopted by the Legislative Assembly in 2016. The other difference that you will see between the Senate and House bills in this section is with regard to free allocations to covered entities that are engaged in emissions intensive trade exposed processes. These are the leakage provisions. In Section 16, sub 4 of the Senate draft, excuse me, I'm going to look at the House draft first, and that's Section 14, sub 4 of the House draft. The Environmental Quality Commission is directed to contract with third-party entities to identify EITEs. In the Senate draft, the EITEs are specified in the legislation using the North American Industry Classification System, also known as the NICS codes. In both bills, EQC is required to hire a contract with a third party to assist in gathering data and conducting analysis necessary to understand leakage risk and adopt rules relating to free allocation for leakage. The Commission is required in both bills to review those rules every 3 years and to add or remove new industries as appropriate, and there is also a process for the Commission to update those rules in between the 3-year review under certain circumstances. The other provisions for free allocation that are in both bills are that DEQ must put some portion of the allowances into a price containment reserve, and also allows for free allocation to consumer-owned utilities. Consumer-owned utilities may, but are not required, to consign those allowances back to the state for auction, and it's up to the governing boards of the consumer-owned utilities how they're going to use consignment proceeds if they decide to consign allowances. That said, the governing boards are required to provide reports to the legislature detailing what their decisions were for how to use that money. Getting back to looking just at LC 44, the Senate draft, I know I said I'd go through the bills in chronological order. I am going to skip over Section 17 for just a minute. I'll come back to it to discuss the provisions for other ways that DEQ can distribute allowances. So I've talked about distributing allowances for free. The other way that DEQ can distribute allowances is through a state-run auction, and the auction provisions are in Section 18 of the draft. The important thing that I'd like to highlight here is that these are state-run auctions of allowances. The proceeds from the sale of auction of allowances that are consigned to the state for auction, those proceeds are required to be transferred back to the entity that consigned the allowances. However, the proceeds from the sale at auction of the rest of the allowances are payable to the state, and they're required to be deposited in the auction proceeds distribution fund established under Section 26 of the Senate draft. That's Section 24 of the House draft, which I'll discuss a little more when we get to that broader conversation. Also, just generally, I'd like to note here that once distributed, allowances can be traded by covered entities on a secondary market. And I make note of that because it is that secondary market activity that is the trade component of a cap and trade program. The state does not receive proceeds from entities buying and selling allowances on the secondary market, nor does the state receive proceeds from the generation and sale of offsets, which I'll discuss next. The proceeds that are coming to the state are only through the auction process that sets up under Section 18 of the bill. I wanted to clarify that. So we've talked about a lot about allowances. Part of the reason they're so important is because they're one type of compliance instrument that covered entities can use to prove compliance. The other kind of compliance instrument that can be used is called an offset credit, and offsets are what is talked about in Section 17 of the Senate draft. In general, an offset credit is generated by an offset project. The draft defines an offset project as a project that reduces or removes greenhouse gas emissions that are not regulated emissions. The offset provisions in the draft place a number of specific limitations on offset projects and the use of offset credits, and they also contain the final substantive difference between the House and the Senate bills. In the Senate version, a total of no more than 8% of a covered entity's compliance obligation may be met by surrendering offset credits, and furthermore, a total of no more than 4% of a covered entity's compliance obligation may be met by surrendering offset credits that are sourced from an offset project that does not provide direct environmental benefits in this state. In the House version, those percentages are reduced such that a total of no more than 4% of the covered entity's compliance obligation can be covered by offsets, and furthermore, 2%, no more than 2% can be covered by offsets sourced from a project that does not provide direct environmental benefits to the state. So now we have all the differences between the two drafts out of the way. I'm going to continue to focus the rest of my comments just on LC Draft 44 for ease of presentation. The final section within the series of provisions for setting up the cap and trade regulatory program is Section 19 of the Senate draft. Section 19 sets forth requirements related to the state of Oregon pursuing linkage agreements with other jurisdictions that have comparable market-based greenhouse gas regulatory programs. There are a few other provisions in the bill before we get to the investments piece. One is that references to impacted communities are present in both the offset provisions of the bill and in the investment provisions. Section 20 of the draft directs the Environmental Quality Commission to consult with certain other agencies and the Program Advisory Committee to designate impacted communities using a methodology that takes into consideration certain criteria that are laid out in the bill. Sections 21 to 23 require persons that are currently required to register and report greenhouse gas emissions to DEQ to, beginning on July 1st of 2019, pay to the Department of Environmental Quality a program development fee that will be used for paying the department's expenses in developing and preparing for implementation of sections 8 to 20 of the draft. That development fee is repealed in 2021. And I believe that the amount of the fee is currently blank in the bill. Yes. So we now get to the investment provisions. These are the provisions that direct the use of proceeds that are received through the state-run auctions conducted under Section 18 of the draft. Sections 24 and 25 require consignment proceeds that are received by electric companies and natural gas utilities to be spent within their own service territories for activities that serve to reduce greenhouse gas emissions or to stabilize or reduce energy bills for customers, and prioritizing low-income residential customers. And the sections allow the Public Utility Commission, to adopt rules to carry out the provisions of those sections. Section 26 is the section that sets up the auction proceeds distribution fund. So as I mentioned earlier, all of the proceeds from the auctions that are payable to the state first go into this distribution fund. Once they're in the fund, the Department of Environmental Quality is going to work with ODOT DEQ is going to certify the amounts that are available for distribution. They're going to work with ODOT to make a determination of which monies in those funds constitute revenues described in Article 9, Section 3A of the Oregon Constitution. Any monies that are that constitute such revenues are required to be deposited in the Transportation Decarbonization Investments Fund that is established under Section 29 of the draft. Once that distribution is made, and looking to the remaining money in the fund after that distribution, 85% of that remaining money is transferred to the Climate Investments Fund established under Section 28 of the draft, and then the final 15% of that remaining money is transferred to the Just Transition Fund that is established under Section 33 of the draft.
Maureen, could I just interrupt for a sec? Just for the sake of our audience, you referenced a constitutional limitation. Could you just explain that, what we're talking about there?
Yes.
These are funds that are related to transportation, is that right?
That is correct. So Article 9, Section 3A of the Constitution requires revenues from any tax levied on with respect to or measured by the storage, withdrawal, use, sale, distribution, importation, or receipt of motor vehicle fuel or any other product used for the propulsion of motor vehicle fuel to be used exclusively for certain highway purposes. And because here, one of the types of fuel that will very likely be regulated under the program is motor vehicle fuel, it is expected that there will be proceeds from the auction that are considered revenues as described under that constitutional provision and so dedicated to highway uses.
Great. And just to specify, to clarify, highway doesn't mean state highways, right? It has a broader meaning.
So the specific limitations in Article 9, Section 3A are that it shall be used exclusively for construction, reconstruction, improvement, repair, maintenance, operation, and use of public highways, roads, streets, and roadside rest areas in this state. So as you will see in sections 27 to 32 of the draft, both the Climate Investments Fund and the Transportation Decarbonization Investments Fund are continuously appropriated to the Department of Administrative Services, which is then charged with distributing the monies and the funds as those monies are allocated by the Legislative Assembly through the biennial budget process to be used for certain projects, programs, and activities that meet the criteria for distributions of monies from those funds. For the Climate Investments Fund set forth in Section 28 of the bill, the criteria are that the money must be used for projects, programs, and activities that fit within the purposes set forth in Section 11 of the draft. And again, those purposes relate to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, promoting carbon sequestration, adaptation, and resilience in the face of climate change. There's also a requirement that the monies in the Climate Investment Fund must be distributed such that 60% of the monies in the fund each biennium is allocated for projects, programs, or activities that are to the benefit of or geographically located in impacted communities. 20% then goes to investments in natural and working lands, and the remaining 20% may be used for anything else that meets the overall purposes stated in Section 11 and any other, like, broadly over-encompassing purposes that are stated in Section 28 and Section 30. For monies in the Transportation Decarbonization Fund, those monies must also be used in a manner consistent with the purposes stated in Section 11. And because the monies in this fund are ones that have been determined to be revenues described in Article 9, Section 3A of the Oregon Constitution, they must also be used exclusively for the purposes described in that constitutional provision that I read off to you earlier. Also, 60% of those monies must be allocated for purposes that benefit impacted communities. Section 30 of the bill provides further direction regarding the types of investments that may be made with monies from the Climate Investment Fund and, to the extent consistent with the Oregon Constitution, the Transportation Decarbonization Fund. Section 31 requires the governor to consider the recommendations of the Program Advisory Committee in their report that I spoke to earlier and that is prepared under Section 10 of the draft. And when preparing the governor's recommendations for expenditures and investments of auction proceeds in the governor's budget. And this ties again to the overall idea that the distribution of these proceeds happens through the budget process. So there will be recommendations the governor's budget for how the money will be used that are also considered similar to how the governor's budget is considered by the Legislative Assembly during the normal budget process. Section 32 gives Department of Administrative Services some rule authority to implement the investment provisions that I just discussed. Sections 33 and 34 of the bill establish the Just Transition Fund and appropriate the monies in that fund to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop a Just Transition program to provide financial support, mental health services for workers dislocated or adversely affected by climate change or climate change policies, and to provide other similar workforce services. Section 35 updates the Department of Environmental Quality's greenhouse gas reporting requirements as necessary to support implementation of the cap and trade program. Sections 36 through 46 are conforming amendments. Section 7 provides for direct review to the Supreme Court on the question of whether the draft is a bill for raising revenue subject to origination and three-fifths vote requirements under the Oregon Constitution. Section 48 is an appropriation to the Environmental Justice Task Force, which has a variety of consultation rules throughout this draft. Section 49 is the operative dates, which I've discussed mostly throughout the rest of the course of the presentation. Section 50 requires the DEQ to provide a status report on rulemaking toward implementation of the program. They are required to do that status report by September 15th of 2020, so that's prior to implementation of the program. And then under Section 51, they're also required to do a 10-year review after implementation, and that would be a report that is required by the year 2031. Section 52 is a technical provision, and Section 53 is the emergency clause of the bill.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you for putting the specifics of the program on the record. That was kind of technical, colleagues, but I think important. For a more sort of plain English version of the major changes from 1070 to this, you do have in your meeting materials some information that was sent out to work group members a few weeks ago, kind of summarizing the changes in a bullet point kind of format. Questions for Maureen? Yes, Senator Roebling.
So as we go through the deal, we recognize that there are some non-regulated entities, mm-hmm. such as agriculture, fishing, marine. Mm-hmm. However, all of the transportation fuels are going to be regulated or part of the process, correct? So aviation fuel and marine fuels, they will be in this process. Is that correct or not?
So, Senator Dembrough, Senator Roblin, marine and aviation fuel are specifically exempted.
So they will not be in.
So they will not be covered.
I just
covered.
Want to make sure it's clear about that.
Yeah. Marine and aviation fuel are exempted, and there's also a provision allowing for the Environmental Quality Commission to determine what a de minimis amount of right. Imported gas and diesel fuel is, and they can exclude from regulation importers that only bring in that de minimis amount.
Okay. Yes, Senator Richard.
Just to tag along here with Senator Roblin, how about off-highway fuel, which is used for construction, logging, agriculture, all of those types of activities?
Senator Dembrough, Senator Barrett-Sugar, there is not a specific exemption in the bill. There is not a specific exemption in either drafts at this time for fuel that is used in non-road vehicles.
Yes, Vice Chair.
Are landfills exempt?
Senator Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, under Section 13, Sub 2A, there is an exemption from regulation for methane emissions from a landfill if those methane emissions are demonstrated to have been recaptured and used for generation of renewable energy, but otherwise no.
Representative Retschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. McGee, for your testimony today. You mentioned that that aviation and marine fuel are exempt. Does that preclude that they will never be included down the line? So in the future, could they be put in this program?
So, Senator Dembrough, Representative Retschke, as the draft is written now, it states that the commission shall exclude from regulated emissions the emissions from combustion of fuel demonstrated to have been used in watercraft or aviation fuel. So as written now, it is it's a full exclusion.
Follow up.
That doesn't preclude, though, that future legislatures could add it in. Is that correct?
Senator Dembrough, Representative Retschke, that, of course, a future legislature could certainly amend this provision to allow for marine and aviation fuel to be covered, but it wouldn't be something that could be done through the rulemaking process. The statute would have to be amended.
Thank you.
And Representative, let me just explain from a policy perspective why we made that decision, really for a couple of reasons. Those fuels are excluded in other jurisdictions that are following a cap and invest kind of model. And although we know that, Boeing and, some other creative people are trying to come up with alternative low-carbon kinds of fuels, it's not there now. And I think the same is probably true of marine fuel as well. If we get to a point where there is the technology where it would make sense to expect industry to take steps to move towards adopting those lower carbon alternatives, then I think it would be really incumbent on the legislature to look at should this be part of the program. So I think that was the rationale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up before we got away from landfills mm-hmm. to ask, and following up on Senator Olson's question, in the section on emissions-intensive trade-exposed entities, mm-hmm. Section R includes solid waste landfills. And so while not exempted, it might help for you to explain what that means for that category of landfill.
This is
It's within the group that we are, the Senate bill identifies as essentially being preloaded for EITC treatment. And that's...
So the version of the draft published...
Did we remove that?
Yeah, the version of the draft published on the 8th does not include that.
Okay, my mistake.
But again, any emissions that are captured and put to renewable use don't count as emissions that need to be regulated. So they don't count in terms of the above 25,000 cap that would bring a landfill into regulation. Yes, Brett Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you for the very exhaustive explanation of this complex policy proposal. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the intent and the use of the consignments that would go to utilities. What's the purpose of that? How? What does the bill say in terms of the use of these consignments?
Chairs, Rep. Marsh, I'm happy to speak to what the bill says. So there are kind of two groups of consignment proceeds. There's consignment proceeds that would go to consumer-owned utilities, and then there's consignment proceeds that would go to utilities regulated by the Public Utility Commission. Regarding the consumer-owned utilities, let me flip to that provision of the bill. Regarding consumer-owned utilities, the Environmental Quality Commission may adopt rules that allow for the consumer-owned utilities to consign their directly distributed allowances. And the bill provides that proceeds from the sale of those allowances must be used by the consumer-owned utility for the benefit of ratepayers, consistent with the purposes stated in Section 11 of the Act, and as further required by the governing body of the consumer-owned utility. And it also requires that any consumer-owned utility that receives directly distributed allowances, the governing board of those utilities is required to submit a report to the legislature each even-numbered year on the uses by the utility of the allowances, and that has to include a description of the uses of the auction proceeds if they decide to consign the allowances. Regarding the consignments of the consignment proceeds that goes to entities regulated by the Public Utility Commission, again, that's in sections 24 and 25 of the Senate draft. And the PUC is going to consult with the Housing and Community Services Department, as well as the Program Advisory Committee, for adopting rules to carry out these sections. What the sections specify in statute is that the money needs to be used only for activities to only, first, it has to be spent within the service territory of the electric company or natural gas utility that is receiving the proceeds. It must be used only for activities that serve to reduce greenhouse gas emissions or to stabilize or reduce energy bills for customers. And it also includes priorities such that the proceeds must be used for activities that benefit the following customers in the following order. And it's first low-income residential customers, including but not limited to those customers that are tenants, and then all other customers, including residential customers, small commercial customers, and energy-intensive industrial customers that are not covered entities receiving allowances directly allocated at no cost under Section 16 of the Act. It also provides that those utilities shall prioritize the use of the auction proceeds for bill assistance, weatherization, and energy efficiency measures. And it provides that except where they may provide some volumetric bill assistance to low-income residential customers, any other bill assistance that provided is to be provided in a non-volumetric manner.
Thank you.
Senator Bentz and then Rep. Rush. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Bentz, if you could hold. Rep. Boone had her hand up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if there was any attention given to a regional approach or how this plan will connect with other states' efforts. And I guess that's one question.
So, Chairs, Representative Boone, there are a few mentions kind of throughout sections 12 to 19 of the bill that serve to clarify that that EQC is directed to develop the program in a way that would facilitate linkage. But I think that the provision that may be of most interest to your question is section 19 of the draft, which specifically addresses linkage with market-based compliance mechanisms in other jurisdictions. And it requires the EQC in adopting all of the rules that they're required to adopt under this program to consider the mechanisms that are in other jurisdictions to implement the program in a manner that avoids double counting of emissions or emissions reductions kind of between those linked jurisdictions and enables the state to pursue linkage agreements. And it also lays out a process for entering into those linkage agreements.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Senator Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Maureen, thank you for all this excellent work. The question I have has to do with the authority that this bill grants the EQC. Mm-hmm. And I was just looking at page 5 of the bill, line 29. It says, the EQC shall adopt by rule, and then it says, a statewide greenhouse gas emissions reduction goal to levels that are, quote, at least 20%. Mm-hmm. And so that means it could be more, and thus we are delegating more authority to the EQC than one might think is wise. Now, I know there are oversight mechanisms that you've placed in that are here that I guess are designed to assure that the legislature isn't overly delegating power and authority to the EQC. My question to you is, how I haven't read the bill with as closely as I will. How does this group up here make sure the EQC doesn't go crazy with the authority this bill grants it? Where does that, other than just coming back and passing another law, what are the tools in this bill that prevent that from happening? In other words, how do we make sure the legislative authority that we enjoy is not being overly delegated to the EQC?
Senator Denbrough, Senator Bentz, you are correct that the way that Section 4 is drafted in terms of the greenhouse gas reduction goals, it does say at least 20% below 1990 levels, for example. And so I do understand the concern that perhaps the EQC could interpret that direction to adopt levels that are more than 20% before 1990 levels.
Excuse me if I could interrupt. Is this language different from the current statutory direction that we have? Does it also talk about at least?
Senator Denbrough, I don't have that statute in front of me right now, but I believe that it is written in a similar manner, that it is at least a percentage reduction. But I don't have that language in front of me now. Senator Bentz, I'd be happy to think about your question some more and get back to you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Reschke and then Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. McGee, do you have an estimate of how many new state employees will be required to ramp up the program and then maintain it going on?
Senator Denbrough, Representative Reschke, that would be a question that would best be directed to the agencies that need to implement the program, and so I would be happy to defer that question to experts that may be in the room and able to answer it for you.
We'll come back to that.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you. Just to follow up, it's actually a little different question. And you may not be able to answer it. Maybe the chairs can. Why the emergency?
Senator Denbrough, Representative Reschke. The effect of the emergency clause, I think the proponents can speak a little bit more to why, but what I can say is that the effect of the emergency clause here is to get certain things in motion immediately after passage of the bill. One of those is the direct review to the Supreme Court. To the extent that there may be a challenge to the bill, it allows for that provision to go into effect immediately. It also allows for the agencies that are charged with adopting rules under the program, even though most of the provisions of the bill don't become effective until after January 1st of 2019, the emergency clause paired with a delayed operative date allows for the agencies that are charged with rulemaking authority to gear up the rulemaking process before the provisions actually become operative. For example, the cap and trade program is not set to become operative until January 1st of 2021, but the technical folks from DEQ would likely tell you that it's going to take some time for them to do rulemaking, and so the emergency clause allows for them to have adequate time to do a rulemaking for the program to be able to be ready to go as of January 1, 2021.
Okay, I guess I understand how the emergency clause works and why you'd implement it, but that could apply to any legislation we do. I'm asking why specifically for this piece of legislation we have to do the emergency clause.
Yeah, and I'll just throw in, this was something that we talked about and made this affirmative decision. For those of you in the audience, this is something the legislature's been wrestling with over the last couple of years. There was kind of almost an automatic process of putting emergency clauses on all our bills, and emergency clause allows it to go into effect immediately rather than having to wait until the next January 1st. And so we're trying as a legislature to look at bill by bill. Does this need an emergency clause or does it not? And we looked at it, and for the reasons that Maureen mentioned, getting the clock ticking on any potential judicial review that would be needed, as well as allowing the steps to be taken to be initiated immediately in order to keep us on this timeline, an emergency clause made sense. I'm sorry, Vice Chair Olson.
Just to clarify that point, Ms. McGee, you can answer this question. The emergency clause also precludes a referral to the people, correct?
Referendum.
A referendum.
Referendum for the people.
Senator Denbrough, Senator Olson, I would like to get back to you on that question, if you don't mind. Because I think I would like to think through that and exactly when that would be of most concern and why.
Yeah, and let me just clarify. It has to do with the timeline for the referendum. It definitely does not preclude a referendum.
Exactly.
But it shortens the time period, I think,
to my original question, if I could. You wrote this legislation. How many areas in there are there fees charged prior to this program going into effect?
Senator Denbrough, Senator Olson, I believe that there are two. There is a, let me take a look here. So if you're looking at the Senate version, in sections 21 and 22 of the bill, those allow for a Department of Environmental Quality program development fee, and that's a fee that would be charged by DEQ prior to implementation of the cap and trade program, with the monies from that fee going to covering the department and the commission's costs in developing the program. So that's one area.
Is that the one that starts in 2019 and ends in 2021?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
And then I think the other area that you would likely, that could be characterized to fit within your question would be in section 35 of the bill. These are updates to Department of Environmental Quality's existing greenhouse gas emission registration and reporting requirements. And as part of the, and what's happening in here is updates to this existing program that are meant to facilitate DEQ being able to use that information as necessary to run the cap and trade program. And as part of those updates, and you'll find this on page 44 of the Senate bill, there is a provision that allows for the Environmental Quality Commission to establish a schedule of fees for registration and reporting under this section. Now, it may be helpful to have someone from the department follow up and correct me if I'm incorrect on this, but I believe that fee authorization will be an expansion of the current fee authorization that they have under the registration and reporting requirements.
Did you miss the fee on the outside consultant on leakage?
So that would be in section 16. Let me look back. Section 16 doesn't become... I haven't found the language. Could you point me to the specific language that you're looking at, Senator, please?
I don't know what... I just got the draft in front of me, but you had mentioned that they would have to hire outside consultants
16-4A.
To define leakage, and I would assume someone would have to pay for that.
So I understood your question, Senator Olson, to be what fees would go into effect before the cap and trade program goes into effect. Section 16, which requires the hiring of that third party consultant, is a provision that is part of what goes into effect in 2021. In terms of whether or not becomes operative 2021, excuse me, in terms of the department needing to pay for whatever third-party consulting they would need to do prior to the operative date, that, and again, it would probably be best for the department to follow up on this, but I would imagine that how much money they would need to pay for that third-party consultant would be part of the consideration that would go into determining how much that program development fee that is in effect from July 2019 through January 2021 needs to be.
Vice Chair, let me say that in a moment, I'll ask Colin McConaughey from DEQ to come up. Sorry, Colin. to deal with some of those program design issues. I will just quickly say that, you know, what we're talking about here are administrative costs of the program. Once the program gets underway and the auctions begin, the program will pay for those ongoing administrative costs. The fees are to get us to that point. And I think he can explain that more. So if we could just, with our last couple of minutes with Maureen, focus on anything legal, technical, that would be great.
Okay, I have a technical question. A legal technical question. And I'm not certain exactly where it is in the bill, but in the summary that was deftly provided by our chair, it says impacted communities are now clearly defined as areas that are disproportionately affected by environmental pollution. Who would be the arbiter of the term disproportionately affected by environmental pollution? And are we determining that CO2 is environmental pollution? Because if it is, we're polluting today in this room.
So, Senator Denbrough, Senator Olson, so I think that the relevant provisions for you to look at in evaluating that would be there is a definition of impacted communities in section 12 sub 15 of the bill. So I'd look to that first. It says that impacted communities means communities most at risk of being disproportionately impacted by climate change, as designated by the Environmental Quality Commission under Section 20 of this 2018 Act. So then we turn to Section 20, and Section 20, and this gets to your question, Senator Olson, about who's the arbiter. Section 20 states that the Environmental Quality Commission, by rule and in consultation with the Portland State University Population Research Center, the Oregon Health Authority, the Program Advisory Committee that is established under Section 8 of the Act, and any other relevant state agencies and local agencies and officials shall designate impacted communities. So it's going to be an actual designation of this community as designated by census tract is an impacted community. They're going to do that. And in doing so, they are statutorily obligated to use a methodology that takes into consideration geographic, socioeconomic, public health, and environmental hazard criteria. And to your question, more to your question of exactly what the bill says about kind of who those impacted communities are and how we define pollution, the bill states that these impacted communities are areas that include, but are not limited to, areas with above average concentrations of low-income households, high unemployment, low levels of homeownership, high rent burden, sensitive populations or residents with low levels of educational attainment, areas disproportionately affected by environmental pollution and other hazards that can lead to negative public health effects, exposure, or environmental degradation. And it requires, in developing that methodology, to give greater weight to criteria that the Commission determines are the most accurate predictors of vulnerability to the impacts of climate change and ocean acidification. It also requires the Commission to update the methodology and the designation of impacted communities once every 5 years.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Maureen. Mm-hmm. Representative Brocksmith, you have the last question.
Well, thank you, Senator. And thank you, Ms. McGee, for all of your time and effort in this. Senator Olson kind of jumped my question with regards to, but I have it as Section 18, which is impacted communities in the Senate version, not Section 20.
Yeah, so Senator Denbrough, Representative Brock-Smith, the Senate version is LC 44.
Oh, that's right.
The House version is LC 176. Sorry. So I think you're looking at the House version,
sir. I am, indeed.
Yeah.
And then, secondly, my question is, with regard, there's been a lot of conversation about how this is helping rural Oregon. I am rural Oregon. When it comes to rulemaking throughout this document with allocations and allowances and so forth, how much of this legislation and the impacts and allowances and so forth is going to be left up to not the legislators through the legislation, but the agencies themselves through the rulemaking process?
Senator Denbrough, Representative Brock-Smith, this is a very interesting question. I'm not sure that I can necessarily estimate for you at this time what the split is, I think, between how many decisions are covered by the statute and how many, like, specific decisions are going to be covered by rule if one were to compare those side by side. And perhaps what I would encourage is to look at the provisions, specifically Section 8 of the bill that sets up the Program Advisory Committee and the membership of who is on that committee, as that Program Advisory Committee kind of plays, it's required by statute as to who that's going to be, but then they play a role in decision-making. I think that your question probably gets to some policy considerations that your colleagues would be happy to answer for you. But I'm not sure I can kind of estimate that split for you right now.
Yeah. And let me just say, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, we took great pains to try to enhance the legislature's role in providing oversight here. You know, so every investment decision, every broad investment decision is going to have to travel through the legislature, through the new Joint Committee on Climate, and then the Ways and Means process, because we are sensitive to that concern. Maureen, thank you very much. Thank you for all your work, and you know, I have a feeling your work's not over with respect to this, but we look forward to continuing to work with you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Maureen.
Yeah. And Colin, would you come up just for a moment? Thanks. So there were a couple of questions. One related to the question of will there be staffing needs for DEQ, you know, in order to carry out this bill, and the other having to do with fees. So I wonder if you could just touch on those and introduce yourself to the record.
Certainly. Chair Dembrough, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Olson and Vice Chair Power, members of the committees. For the record, my name is Colin McConaughey. I'm the Climate Policy Advisor for the Department of Environmental Quality. And to the question about staffing resources needed at my agency, we are beginning to evaluate that in some detail. We can say with certainty we cannot cover that with existing resources, but we don't have a figure yet. But certainly we're expecting to produce one, at the very least for the fiscal analysis that our agency will need to do for this bill. And then to the second question about the development fees, I think the earlier observation that fee would need to fund both the hiring of a third party, as we're directed to do in this bill, as well as any of those additional staffing needs that we identify, is correct. Essentially, we would my interpretation of the bill at this point is that development fee is designed to cover all of our DEQ's costs, unless there was an apportionment of general fund or some other funding provided to the agency. Unless that occurs, that development fee needs to cover all of our development costs of the program up through January of 2021.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice
Chair. So you have no preliminary estimate of the massive bureaucracy we're going to create.
That's a characterization, Vice Chair, but yes.
Chair Dembrough, Senator Olson, not a dollar figure for you or a headcount yet. That's what we're currently assessing. We just got the bill at the same time everyone else did. So we're beginning to look at that, and we will have that information, but I don't have it for you today.
Follow-up?
Yeah, and let me just say that, you know, certainly prior to the first public hearing on the bill, we will have information about that. We'll have, you know, we're starting to meet with legislative revenue about, you know, projections about the revenues attached to the bill and the effects of the revenues. And that now that the bills have been finalized, those kinds of analyses can begin. So I'm sorry, proceed.
You made me lose my train of thought. You will be the overseer of credits that are sold? DEQ, I should say. Not you, Chris.
Yes. Chair Dembrough, Senator Olson, yes, my interpretation of the bill is that EQC is directed to adopt rules that will then inform how DEQ determines how many allowances are in a given budget, a year's annual budget, and furthermore, how those allowances are allocated.
So, would follow up? So, therefore, would DEQ oversee the actions of WCI in their sale of our credits?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Olson, in the event that the linkage described in this bill results in the program ultimately being linked up with the WCI program that you mentioned, then yes, the DEQ, implementing the rules adopted by our commission, defining how many allowances we have and how many of those are to be sold at that joint auction that that occurs in the WCI system, yes, we would be directing how many allowances are coming from Oregon into that joint auction.
So to delve into the weeds a little bit, as you're given these different responsibilities, how do you as management sit down and figure out we need two bodies for this and 18 for that? Because we looked at ODOT, and they need 153 new bodies to do the transportation package. This is as enormous, if not more, not particularly dollar-wise, but in the encompassing the entire state, looking at low-income, disadvantaged communities. How are you going to determine your needs so that we can honestly look at and say, this is the cost, and it's worth the cost to do this?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, that is a great question, and one we are doing it in a couple different ways. One is simply the internal process of evaluating closely all the different tasks and activities that we believe would be entailed to implement the program requirements. That's what you'd expect, I think, of any agency evaluating a bill and determining staffing resource requirements. But in this case, as you already alluded to, there are systems in place in other jurisdictions that very closely mirror what's required here. So as you might also expect, we have been will continue to be in very close discussion with those jurisdictions about not just the number of individuals, but importantly for a bill like this that describes some pretty sophisticated market systems, the types of expertise and skill sets, that basically the types of positions that will be required. And I said a minute ago that I don't have any numbers for you, but I can with confidence say that the numbers that we will be producing will be considerably lower as far as a headcount of 153. It'll be considerably less than that.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Just a quick question following up with Senator Olson. Could we please have those numbers earlier on in the session instead of the last minute?
We'll have them for you by the time the session begins, Senator.
Okay.
Yes, I said that. Senator Roblin.
So we talked about the auction, and we're not planning on doing our own auctions. We're going to go. Are there other places that you are investigating that the EQC can actually rely on other people as opposed to us hiring new employees? And are we looking at those?
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, I think in a couple places in the bill, actually, it directs us to rely on the expertise of a third party. So I think those my initial observation or interpretation of those locations where you see that type of direction to us is that those fall in areas that I think are wisely chosen, because those would otherwise doing some of that work, such as the assessment of leakage risk internally at our agency, would require probably a more expensive hiring process to do that. So that's one area where I'm sure that's what you're referring to. But that's one area where I think the bill alleviates some of the demand for internal resources that would be required to implement the bill. But the as we've described in the past, the linkage that's possible here and that this bill more specifically directs us to pursue, that linkage also is a cost-sharing provision, essentially. It shares in the cost of some of those administrative systems and platforms necessary to do the auction, to monitor the auction, to monitor the market. And so I can also say, I think, with confidence that the our assessment of the costs to stand up this program and then ultimately run it will take into account some of that cost sharing, and I think that our assessments would probably be otherwise would be higher if we did not anticipate some of that that cost sharing and resource sharing, as well as, frankly, I also want to acknowledge some pretty considerable support to date, and I have no reason to think it would go away from those jurisdictions in helping us understand what's needed and understand how to design a program like this and some of the lessons that they've learned along their way.
Yes, Senator Vance, and let's make this the last question.
So I was just checking to see if my memory was correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair, that the Secretary of State's audit recently found that you guys are, in their opinion, some 200 employees short as we speak. And I just checked. That was 4 days ago when that audit result came out. And I think what we're hearing up here is we don't want that. We don't want that. If you're already 250 people down, and we're now, this bill suggests a whole bunch more work. I think what we're all saying is, hey, time to be really, really clear in what it is it's going to take, because you're already way overworked according to the audit. Now, did the Secretary of State get it wrong? Or I hate to put you on the spot, but that's what you're there for. So, so share with us how you're going to address the 250 you're short and whatever this new workload might be.
Chair Dembrough, Senator Benz, I cannot myself speak directly to the results of the audit and how we will respond to those. That is outside of my wheelhouse at the agency as the agency's climate policy advisor. But I will say that the types of staff that I believe the audit points out are lacking at the agency are not the types of staff and individuals that we would need to hire to set this program up. So it would not be directly robbing the existing deficit to bring over people, for example, that are already doing our permit programs. Those are not the types of staff that would be needed to set up this program. So I think there are really two. In the event of passage of this bill, we would be looking at hiring new and distinct individuals. Then we might also be looking to hire to fill that deficit that you observed from the audit.
Thank you.
Great. Yeah, and I think we're all sensitive to the staffing challenges at DEQ, and that's why we want to design this program to be self-sufficient in terms of its staffing. We don't want to add to the problem. We want it to pay for itself, as it were. Okay, Colin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. Colleagues, with the remainder of our time meeting jointly, we have Lori Wayburn, who is going to walk us through a presentation on forest offsets. Oh, and Rep Helm is going to sort of tee this up.
Lori, welcome, and thank you for making time to bring this information forward to us. Colleagues, this presentation is a result of a conversation that Lori and I had, a month and a half ago, about the work that she does implementing an offset program. And so, and it's been going on for a while. And so there's a track record there, and there's good interaction with the offset markets. Some results that she can share that impact Oregon and impact the local economy. So thank you for taking that conversation and putting together the type of information that we talked about, and I appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Chair Dembrough, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Power, and Vice Chair Olson, for the opportunity to be here. This is a very important hearing. My organization, the Pacific Forest Trust, was founded to maintain the working forest landscape primarily through finding complementary sources of income to those that landowners traditionally rely upon to maintain their working forests as forests, that being timber, by identifying revenue for wildlife habitat, for water services, and especially for climate. We've been involved in forests and climate for about 25 years, and we're involved in the policy development in the state of California, including forests within the climate policy through the offset program and as a sector. So just to reiterate what you've already heard about carbon offsets, carbon emissions reductions projects are offsets, are a key tool within the forest sector. They are a way to voluntarily engage the power of the forest sector in helping solve the climate crisis through activities in a non-regulated sector, that is forest, with those of the regulated sector, and to engage people and lands and communities in helping solve that crisis and be rewarded for it that they would not otherwise be rewarded for. Forest carbon offsets, as mentioned, now cover about somewhere over 5 million acres across the country. There are 28 states that are involved in developing forest carbon offsets. These are range from Alaska to Alabama to Arkansas. You can walk through the alphabet of states that are engaged. Oregon has about 185,000 acres in that compliance trading market currently. Over 50% of these emissions reductions projects are done by timber companies and timber investment management organizations. The remainder are done through tribes, families, and individuals. About a third of those projects are in California. The remainder are obviously nationally. As Chair Dembro has noted, when looking at the climate crisis, engaging forests and other land is a critical piece of action that we have to do. When you look at climate projections, the so-called safe line, the green line, the only way we will get to that is by working with forests and other lands. So, simply speaking, a carbon offset allows somebody within the, or an entity within the regulated community to meet their obligations through trading with an entity outside the regulated area, in this case through forests. And a forest carbon project involves either increased sequestration, decreased emissions, or combinations of both. And I'd want to note that the vast majority of these are through managed forests. The three kinds of projects that there are under the existence compliance trading systems are those that reduce emissions by avoided conversion, those that restore higher levels of carbon to forests through improved forest management, and those that do reforestation of lands that have been out of forest but are naturally forest for a period of time. The key characteristics of an offset project, and these are actually identified in the legislation as it stands now, is that they are additional to what would happen otherwise. You know, we don't pay people to stop at the stop sign. They have to do that. We pay them for when they're really good drivers in the form of a subsidy. They must be real, measurable, and standardized, so it's not a matter of my opinion or somebody else's opinion about what makes for additionality and what's good measurement. They are verifiable by an accredited third party. They are permanent, defined as 100 years, so that a ton taken out of the atmosphere is out of the atmosphere for 100 years. And they are enforceable, that they have a legally binding contract and you have the rule of law behind you. I want to take a minute to talk about this issue of permanence. Forests, unlike other sectors, has the remarkable ability to reabsorb emissions. But when a ton of CO2 is emitted as a pollutant, it stays in the atmosphere for thousands of years. When you look at this and you recognize that we are looking at reduction within 60 years of 50% of it, you have to tail on out another 1,000 to, in fact, 10,000 years to reabsorb the whole of the ton. So if you're going to have a trading system that allows for a ton of pollution to go out, you want to have some reliance that the ton that you're pulling in is going to stay there for the long term. And I realize that I have not been using the clicker. I apologize.
There you go.
You've been very articulate.
The second one, projects, bending the curve, what a carbon offset is, three kinds of projects, and these characteristics. I do apologize with that. And this is the graphing on the lifetime of a ton of CO2 that is emitted and why it is important to take long-term action there. So one of the aspects of offsets is having this real measurable, verifiable, and standardized approach. While that can sound daunting, it is also relatively straightforward if you are in the forest industry in any way, shape, or form. It really is a matter of the number of acres that are involved, the volume on those acres that is growing and that is removed, and the resilience of those over time. One of the characteristics of the offset program that is the compliance offset program out of California that it is that it requires working with forests that naturally occur in those areas. So rather than being focused on plantations, for example, Some of you may have heard of a species called Lucania out of Southeast Asia. It grows very, very fast, but it doesn't grow here. It is not resilient. It will not do as well as the species that we have here. And Oregon is, of course, world famous for the productivity of its forests. The accounting system is really based on what are the store and emissions areas of forests. So when you harvest a forest, roughly a third goes into a product, roughly a third is emitted in the short term, and roughly a third decays slowly over time, some into the soils and some into the atmosphere. Within these accounting protocols, obviously product stores are counted, so the third that gets transferred into products is accounted for, and the remainder accounting is done on the livestock in the forests. These do not focus on soils. Soils are very, very expensive to do the inventory for, and frankly, if the stocks are increasing in the forest, they're increasing in the soils as well. So let me talk about the three kinds of offset projects there are. Improved Forest Management, or IFM, is far and away the largest category of these projects. And when we talk about how credit is generated, in Improved Forest Management, there is a standardized baseline, which is derived from what's called the Common Practice Indicator, looking at the forests around where the project is, what is the average of stocks that is there, and contrasting that standardized baseline to what the project has. If there are stocks above that Common Practice Indicator baseline and the project agrees to keep those, they get what is called avoided depletion. It can be a significant amount of credit up front, and then they get growth over time. If, however, their stocks are below that Common Practice Indicator, then they only get the benefit of growth. They don't have an avoided depletion, but they get the benefit of growth until they reach that baseline, and then after that, they would gain credit from avoided depletion as they keep above that. So that is under the below Common Practice Indicator. Another category of projects are avoided conversion. This is a very small category, frankly, but this is where you have a forest parcel that is in threat of development and conversion and therefore loss of its carbon stocks as well as future growth. So it is really all an avoided depletion project, and there is a methodology for calculating both the likelihood of that development and then waiting it out over time if there were multiple pieces within that to go onto the market and to capture that net present value discount. There are very few reforestation projects as well. However, those are only growth because you're starting from a non-forested state within that. So I just want to emphasize the importance of engaging the power of the forest sector. Forests are a third of the U.S., the 40% plus of Oregon. They have an enormous amount to contribute. And in fact, if Oregon engages in forest carbon offset projects, it is one of the leading states across the country for a solution that can be 40 to 50% of the climate crisis in this country. So with that, I'm very happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Lori. Representative Boone, and then Brock Smith.
Are there any requirements for these private forests to be opened up to the public, like historical homes are, for example?
Chair Dembro and Representative Boone, there's no requirement for public access as part of these projects.
Rep. Brock Smith.
Thank you. Good morning. Appreciate your presentation. Can you go back to the 30-30-30 slide, basically the percentage slide? Right there. And so we know that roughly 1 cubic meter of wood stores about nearly a metric ton of carbon, right?
Depending upon the density, yes, sir. Yeah.
And so when our own Climate Commission report shows that roughly 60%, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Senator, of the greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon are really stored in our forests, if I remember correctly. And then, but roughly similar to your slide here, roughly 30% of that is then released due to fire, decay, and so forth. My question is, what are the efforts in California beforehand, before adopting their own policies that charge industries to go after, you know, the other 30% that isn't stored in trees. What are the policies that they put forward to go after the 30% that is being decayed and therefore releasing the stored carbon back through the greenhouse emissions back into the atmosphere that were done prior to taxing the industries and therefore their citizens?
Chair Dembrough and Representative Smith, if I understand your question correctly, the natural resource industries are not well invested in general, and all states have to struggle with their budgets about what to allocate into improving the sometimes unhealthy or unresilient conditions of their forests in particular. And in fact, through the cap and trade system in California, there's a very significant allocation of funding going into improved forest health across the state. Prior to that, the primary investments, and particularly in a state like California that has had ups and downs in its budget, have been focused on fire suppression. That's had mixed results in terms of the outcomes of the condition of the forest as we see it today. So I'm not sure if I've followed your question correctly, but through the climate policy that is in California, there are now funds being generated through the cap and trade system to actually invest in forests as a sector to improve their health overall.
Mm-hmm. And just to follow up on that, so offset projects, are they focused on forest health specifically? And how so? What would be an example? I know you're talking about direct investments right. from their proceeds to improve forest health. That's something we're very interested in. But can offsets also improve resistance to fires?
Yes. Yeah, so, Chair Dembrough, as you're identifying, there are two different mechanisms. One is the business-to-business opportunity, which is what offsets are. And so, for example, Green Diamond Resource Company has an offset project and sells into the market, or Sierra Pacific Industries has an offset project and sells into the market. And those projects actually do improve forest health. I can speak for a project that we ourselves have developed and managed in a redwood forest, where by developing larger, more fire and pest resistant trees with a thick bark that really creates low fire intrusion into those trees, by doing that, it has improved the resistance and resilience to fire there. Within the Sierra Pacific Industries projects, again, they are developing larger, more fire and pest-resistant trees, reducing spacing, which is one of the issues that also, for example, is one of the challenges with Swiss needle cast, that, you know, too many trees on 1 acre, which limits the light and the moisture, has had a negative impact. By restoring more natural diversity of species, where you can have hemlock in there as well as Doug fir, that also reduces disease and enhances resilience. So by having more natural densities, by having larger trees that are more that have a greater survival characteristic to fire, it does improve forest health as well.
Okay, no, go ahead. Rep Helm, then Vice Chair also.
Lori, we talked about your project outside of Corvallis, if I remember correctly. So my first part of my question is, can you tell us a little bit about how that's gone? What is its nature, and what do you think are the advantages, disadvantages that project has presented? And then as a second question, we're starting to hear a little bit of concern as we roll out this proposal about offset projects both competing for jobs, employees with traditional forest industry, and for the trees themselves in terms of supply. And I wonder if you have any experiences from elsewhere that would give us some insight into whether that competition is in any way significant.
The development of offset projects has not, to my knowledge, resulted in any reduction of employment. I can speak for our own project, where we continue to employ the same number of people through contract logging and contract foresters as we have before. But there are also additional jobs associated with the increased work in inventory and measurement with verification. That are requirements of offset projects. So it is added to employment rather than decreased employment. The forest projects that are the vast majority are those in improved forest management. They, of necessity, involve harvesting of trees. That maintains the growth rate, and you also are accounting for the carbon in product stores. I do want to clarify that the forests that we manage outside of Corvallis, 7,200 acres of Doug Fir-dominated forest, are not in the offset program. Another forest that we manage of 2,200 acres is in the offset program. And we would be delighted if there was any interest, though, in coming out to that forest to see the type of management there, because it is applicable to an offset project. I mean, the fundamental idea of an offset project is that you manage your forest like you manage a bank account, and you want to live off of the interest rather than depleting the principal. And by rebuilding that forest bank account in terms of its total inventory, you're generating more interest every year. And even if your growth rate may slow from 6% to 4%, getting 4% off of $1 million versus 6% off of $100,000, you get more interest. So that is the basic principle that is there. You're going to maintain that forest in management, but you're going to regrow. It's comparable to the old concept of a CMAI, the cumulative mean annual index growth there. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Laurie. Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you. I have actually two questions. The first, are state and federal government eligible to get into this offset program?
Federal government is not part of the offset program. It's a business-to-business opportunity, and states are not.
Secondly, in a business-to-business opportunity, you've purchased credits from an offset supplier, and his forest burns down.
No.
What happens to your business model now that you've generated or you've purchased credits? They're not available anymore. What happens to you?
Chair Dembrough and Vice Chair Olson, that's a great question. There is an automatic buffer and insurance program in the offsets. So one of the key principles is to diversify where the offsets come from. It's a principle similar to forest investing writ large. You yourself are not solely responsible for an insurance program. You contribute into an insurance pool. And that kind of pooling of resources allows the risk to come down across the board. I can tell you of a project in California on 17,000 acres of fir land, a project called University Hill. They had gone through the project process. They had registered. They were verified. They sold their offsets. And 1 week later, there was a devastating fire that moved through. They were covered. They had their insurance. So everybody who participates in the program also participates in that insurance and buffer pool, anticipating that such things can happen.
I'll follow up to that, though. But the question is, once this person is in that credit market and he requires those credits to keep his business going, to keep it established, that credit is not available anymore. What's his the insurance pays back what I assume he invested. But where does he go from there to get more credits?
So, Chair Dembrough,
it seems to
Chair
me that this is a very nebulous process. As long as nothing happens, everything is wonderful. Until a catastrophe happens and 17,000 acres burns up, this person needs these credits to stay in business. They have to go elsewhere.
Chair Dembrough and Vice Chair Olson, if I understand your question correctly, and I think this is also a great question to ask participants in the program, such as Sierra Pacific Industries or Green Diamond, because they have looked at these risks, they already have risk of a forest fire on their lands. And it's part of their business planning. So by having a carbon project, it does not change that one way or the other. The same insurance type of approach that they have to insuring their forests for fire relative to timber, they have a comparable program, except that that program has a much more diversified pool behind it for insurance covering their losses and making them whole relative to, they don't have to pay back for the credits that have been bought.
Senator, I just want to make one little correction because I don't want to generalize. Governments are not available. State government. Tribal governments can, right?
Correct.
And I just want to make sure that people understand. Government in general is not the answer. Government, state, and federal are not are in it. But.
Yeah, that's a good point. We did hear one of the work groups heard about a project on the Warm Springs reservation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If you sell a credit for your forest to an industry, can you go in and still manage a forest and thin trees and make the forest better, or are you stuck for 100 years that it does what it does?
Chair Denbrough and Vice Chair Olson, absolutely. So I'll give you the example of my the project that we developed and manage. Last year, we harvested 1.47 million board foot of timber, and we also sold 25,000 tons of CO2 emissions reductions. So we harvest every year, and in fact, harvesting is a part of how you project what you're doing going forward with an improved forest management project. So you're complementing your timber receipts with carbon receipts. And I can also speak from experience of when stumpage has been down, the carbon prices have paid six-figure checks complementing our income, so that not only did we have some timber income, although it was down, we also had a consistent stream of carbon income. So the two go hand in hand. They are not one or the other.
Follow up to that?
Yes.
So when you cut trees down, then you lose that sequestration ability of that tree. How do you account for that in what you have left standing? Because what you have left standing is not going to offset what you just cut.
The measure, Chair Denbrough and Vice Chair Olson, there is a standardized inventory procedure, and it's just like others in the forest industry who do a standardized inventory of their standing trees. It is not a tree-by-tree approach. It is an across-the-forest approach. So you're not looking at any individual tree. You're looking at your overall stocks. There is growth, there is depletion, but on the whole, there is an arc of increasing volume per stand. And one simple way of looking at that and recognizing it is that if you are harvesting slightly less than growth, so if you are growing your forest at 5% and you are harvesting at 4%, you've left 1% still there. So that is increasing the base stocking of the forest. And your measurements are done in comparison to that standardized baseline. Do you mind if I go back to that slide?
Sure.
So you have a standardized baseline against which you measure your forest. So it is, if you will, it's a counterfactual, which is what's happening around you on a regular basis, and are you managing differently from that? So yes, you will continue to harvest, but on the whole, your stocks will increase. Does that clarify it?
Could you explain how you would quantify your growth rate at 5%? Do you measure the tree and see if it's getting fatter?
There is a standardized inventory protocol as part of the offset system that is under the Air Resources Board in California. So I'd be very happy to provide the link to that standardized inventory protocol.
Thank you.
Great. And by the way, I don't think Maureen really went into this, but one of the elements of the bill you'll notice is in the section on offsets is we will be convening an offset protocol advisory committee with scientists and foresters and dairy and people who are kind of expert in these areas to make sure that our protocols really make sense. Senator Bertrager, I'll give you the last question.
Thank you very much. Ms. Rayburn, you seem to be extremely knowledgeable in this area. It's kind of a very interesting program. I look forward into some more conversations about this particular part. I just hope you're getting more than 4% in Western Oregon off your stand growth.
Chair Denbrough and Senator Bartschinger, just the state overall.
Okay. Lori, thank you very much for coming. It's very informative. Colleagues, so we have reached that point where we are going to have to separate again. Senate members, we are going to be moving. We're going to reconvene over in hearing room C. We have a brief presentation on another aspect of cross-laminated timber, as well as irrigation projects in Central Oregon that are related to a potential LC. And then we will be voting on introduction of committee bills as well. Yes.
I do want to say that I appreciate going from an F to a C.
Yes, that's right.
We're advancing.
Okay.
We're
advancing.
And that was in 2 hours.
And before we, before we recess.
Audience, could you just hold
just
it?
Just one second. Before we recess, my two different devices say we're approximately at 10 o'clock. We'll recess here until 5 after 10. And for folks that might be following this committee on OLIS and live streaming it, you'll need to refresh your browser at that point in order to recapture just the House Committee on Energy and Environment here in this room, hearing room F. Thanks. We'll be back in 5 minutes.
Okay, so I'm going to recess this meeting of Senate Environment and Natural Resources.
Recessing the House Committee on. I'm bringing the House Committee on Energy and Environment back to order. At committee, at this point today, all we have left is a discussion of any legislative concepts that are potentially coming to our committee that are individual member bills that you would like to discuss from that you're bringing. And then we'll move to an introduction of committee bills, and I'll explain when we get to that point. I'll explain that a little more. So at this time, I'd like to invite any committee members. If you have a personal bill that you plan to bring that's energy and environment oriented, I'll invite you to give us a brief overview at this time, if you so desire. Okay, I've got three of you. Why don't I start with Phil?
Okay,
then,
thank you.
Representative Brock Smith and then Representative Holby.
Thank you. LC-119 is a bill that was requested by the governor's office that has to do with minor fixes to the current law having to do with the installation and use of electric vehicle chargers that involve state agencies, motor pools, state employees, and the like. The current law has some problems with the way in which it's determined that you to pay for chargers and fuel, electricity, that make it impractical to actually use them or install them. And so this is an attempt at a fix.
Representative Barnhart, is it correct, is my memory correct, that we attempted to consider this proposal in 2017, but the agency couldn't quite get the fix right that they wanted.
Mr. Chair, they went through several iterations with me over the summer. I don't know whether we have it right or not, but at least it's the next try.
Okay, very good. Representative Brocksmith.
Oh, I just was going to make a comment that we've lost half of our group, as well as Warner and I, have lost half of ours in this whole process.
But our per capita,
and I shower, so I don't know.
Our per capita brain power has increased, though.
Oh,
careful!
Did you go to training yesterday, sir?
Not on our committee. I was referring
so
to.
So what LC is that?
The joint Senate committee, House committee.
Ah, thank you,
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Chair Dimbro. So, colleagues, after my work on the Department of Energy last session, which you may recall, and I had a bill called House Bill 2020, which didn't enjoy the full support to get it through the building, and having gone through that and trying to, you know, work on climate as it relates to the Department of Energy not being something that was fully supported, I have come back, way back, after just looking at all of our oversight of the problems the Department of Energy has had and how they're rectifying those, how they're moving forward. One thing that most everybody agreed was that we should have some sort of board or commission as oversight for the Department of Energy. So I'm bringing back a bill specifically that doesn't have anything to do with climate this time, and it's just the Oregon Department of Energy Oversight Board. So I am introducing that. It's LC 238, and I expect it will come to this committee. It creates a seven-member board. In addition to the seven members, there's also two ex officio members, one of them being from the Northwest Power Council, and also the director of the Department of Energy as well. There's also a bill on the Senate side, maybe two, that are looking at also developing a board or commission. This bill is very simple. It's about 11 pages. The one on the Senate side is over 150, I think. And where we got into trouble last session was trying to revamp the mission of the agency and changing a lot of statutes. This short session, I just feel it's really important to get a board over the top of the Department of Energy to help guide its recommendations, its policies, and also to make sure there's some transparency and accountability for how they're fulfilling their mission. So with that, that's the bill in a nutshell. One of the also major pushbacks I got last session was that in working with the governor's office, they weren't really interested in having an industry-driven board where the industry just controlled the Department of Energy. So we didn't allow any individuals with pecuniary interest to be on that board. In this version, there will be an allowance for a pecuniary interest. It'll be two of the seven members will be allowed to have a pecuniary interest, like a utility or an energy developer or whatnot. So having said that, that's the bill. I look forward to exploring this more in the upcoming session. And thank you very much.
Good. Any other personal bills that we want to discuss? Okay. Thank you. Then at this time, we'll move to committee bills. And I think what I'll do is go ahead and describe them. And I think this is on, just trying to look at our formal agenda, which I buried now. Here it is. I got it. Okay. I was just wondering if we had anything on paper in front of folks. So the... Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. On OLIS, there's a memorandum from Beth to us dated today that discusses LC 165, LC 169, and LC 170. LC 165 is a water bill that is a request coming out of the Klamath Irrigation District. For some flexibility to move water around temporarily within the reclamation project down there. The essential
concern is that the Klamath Basin is in the midst of an adjudication. The administrative part of the adjudication has been completed. The judicial part has not quite gotten underway. And there are irrigated lands, there are lands within the project that are qualified for irrigation rights that have been converted to other uses. And while otherwise allowable, that water has not been able to be transferred. It is, in my mind, in my understanding, it is a very small amount of water. It would need to be temporarily transferred until the judicial adjudication can verify or otherwise deal with what I think exists as claims right now and can be perfected into water rights later, as I understand it. Let me invite Representative Reschke to say any words about the bill. It does affect some of his constituents and parts of his district.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank you for working on this with me and making it a committee bill, and I thank the committee in advance for working on it. A key thing to emphasize is just the Klamath Project. So this piece of legislation will only deal with the Klamath Project. It will not affect and cannot be applied anywhere else out in Oregon. So I want to say that once, twice, underline it, bold it, italicize, well, don't italicize, then it's delete it, but I just want to emphasize that it's only the Klamath Project, and it's only because we're in the situation we're in, and we'll put as many sideboards on it as we need to make sure that folks can transfer water back and forth, and it doesn't add any additional water. It doesn't allow the project to claim any more water than it's has right now. So again, I thank you, Chair Helm, and the committee for working with me on this.
Very good. LC 169 is a bill that it will establish the Oregon Conservation and Recreation Fund. To be honest, it's a little outside the scope of our committee. I'm taking a little bit of prerogative as the chair to bring this bill back forward. This is a bill that was developed during the 2017 session in response to the task force that was developed and held after the 2015 session to try to tackle how we fill an ongoing budget hole at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And one of the side projects that came out of that task force is that we don't have dedicated funding to implement the Oregon Comprehensive Wildlife Strategy. The reason for keeping this bill in front of us and my intention to have it is that there is federal there's a federal appropriations proposal to increase a federal excise tax on sporting equipment to provide additional money to the states for fish and wildlife habitat and species management. It is a sizable pot of money, and part of the proposal is that states would be able to acquire that federal money by match. The match is 4-1. We provide the one, they provide the rest. And so in preliminary figures, what the department is estimating is Oregon could be qualified for up to $45 million of new funds coming from the feds from this new excise tax. And so my thinking, and folks in the outdoor recreation industry in particular, are thinking we want to be ready to grab that money when it becomes available, be first in line. And that means that our match is in the range of $9 to $10 million. So I know we're in a tight budget scenario. We may not be looking at much more revenue than we were seeing in 2017, but the folks in our
traditional sports, outdoor sporting interests like fishing and hunting, as well as the burgeoning outdoor recreation industry, are strongly behind trying to figure out how we fund the wildlife strategy and create this type of fund for accepting federal matching funds into it. LC-170 is a bill that is at the request of the Department of Environmental Quality. We saw this in 2017. It is approving a fee base to stand up and fund Cleaner Air Oregon and to help with the department's efforts to better monitor and implement a health-based set of standards for air quality throughout the state. This bill, as introduced, would limit the amount of fees collected during the July 1, 2017 to July 1, 2019 biennium to $2 million. And so it is this committee, and I can't remember the vote, but I suspect that I know what it was, passed the bill, this similar bill, down to our Ways and Means folks in 2017. The department is asking that we do so again to see if Ways and Means has some money for them to stand up this program. And that's that. Beth or I can try to answer questions if you have them. Okay. Seeing none at this time, what I want in a minute, I'm going to accept a motion from our vice chair requesting that we approve these as committee bills. Before that, I wanted to make sure that I explain to the committee and to the folks listening that a vote to accept these as committee bills does not obligate individual members to support the bills or to oppose the bills in any other way. This is just an acknowledgement that they will become a committee bill for the purposes of discussion during the 2018 session, and there's no obligation one way or the other. So at this time, I'm going to open a work session. Do we want to do these all together? Okay. Sorry. I'm going to open a work session on Legislative Council drafts 165, 169, and 170. And I would invite a motion on these potential bills.
Chair Helm, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC-165, dated 12-28-2017, LC-169, dated 1-8-2018, LC-170, dated 1-8-2018.
Representative Power moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC-165, dated 12-28-2017, LC-169, dated 1-8-2018, and LC-170, dated 1-8-2018. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Thank you, members. I am looking forward to the appointment of the replacements for Representative Johnson and Representative Bentz. To the extent that I think I have that information before the rest of you, I'll pass it on. And I look forward to working with you all again here beginning February 5th. With that, is anything for the good of the order from any of the members? Okay, with that, I'll close the House Committee on Energy and Environment. Good.